This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for downloading The Briefing Room, the programme that tells you what you need to know about what's happening now. This week, we're looking at an American political network known as the alt-right. It's a movement with which Donald Trump's new campaign manager is heavily associated, and Hillary Clinton has made it the latest focus of her anti-Trump rhetoric. But what exactly is the alt-right? Find out now with our presenter David Aronovich and our reporter Mike Wendling.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo. The American people will come first once again. These are the forgotten men and women of our country, and they are forgotten, but they're not going to be forgotten long. These are people who work hard, but no longer have a voice. I am your voice.
In this program, we'll be looking at how the surprising rise of Donald Trump has been accompanied by a new and unexpected political movement which has caused a flurry on social media and is known to itself as the alt-right. Now step inside the briefing room and find out about the alt-right. Joining me will be Milo Yiannopoulos, a figurehead of the movement, and Cathy Young, one of its sharpest critics. But first, our reporter Mike Wendling has set out to define what the alt-right is.
There was a moment this summer when the phrase alt-right first started to get real attention from the mainstream media, and it all started with a tweet.
Next to her face was what appeared to be a Star of David. Emblazoned over the Star of David were the words, "Most corrupt candidate ever." And underneath Hillary Clinton was a giant pile of money.
A picture including what some said was a Jewish symbol, great big piles of money, and Donald Trump's opponent. So were his critics being overly sensitive, or was Trump somehow suggesting some stereotypical conspiracy? Well, it's not really clear because his campaign has refused to fully explain the story behind the image. One thing we do know is that the picture originated on 8chan. That's a website known for extreme images and absolute anything goes free speech. Anthony Smith is a journalist for the website Mike. He's the one who tracked the original image down.
I saw it and I thought, oh my God, what could his campaign possibly be thinking by putting this out there? It's part and parcel of the same amorphous, fragmented movement that's called the alt-right.
Many people who encounter this movement online will be familiar with this sort of story. People who call themselves alt-right share grossly offensive pictures on Twitter and on Facebook and other websites. Believe me when I say that a Star of David on a pile of money is at the more tame end of the spectrum. But if offensiveness and trolling were all there was to it, we wouldn't be discussing it now. There's also a serious strain of thought here. It's nativist, tribalist, anti-establishment, extremely conservative. Anthony Smith describes the movement's origins in the wake of the election of Barack Obama.
In November of 2008, a man named Paul Gottfried, who is president of a society called the H.L. Mencken Society, called for the creation of an alternative right, an independent right that functions not tied to the establishment, so they weren't beholden to necessarily anyone. And because they weren't beholden to anyone, they would be fearsome for anyone that opposed them. At its core, it identified black radicalism, radical feminists, open borders advocates. These are the enemies. So the enemy is progressive society. The enemy is political correctness. From there, in the wake of America electing its first black president, all of a sudden you started to see these people rise from the shadows and really start organizing in a way that they'd never organized before.
For years, the alt-right was just a fringe, mostly online subculture. But interest in it has shot up, along with Trump's presidential prospects. It's intrigued all manner of conservatives who are angry at the establishment, and some people who weren't very conservative to begin with. And it's no longer just an American phenomenon. It's now, if this makes sense, an international nationalist movement. Ian Davis is a supporter. He lives in Surrey, and he runs an alt-right Twitter feed. Unlike many self-described members of the movement, he's happy to give his name. I asked him to give me a rundown of the components of the alt-right. It was eye-opening from the very start.
I've brought my little colourful diagram. It looks like a plate of multicoloured spaghetti, which roughly explains what the alt-right is. And sort of to the left, you have the National Socialists.
And so there's a there's a political movement that has a National Socialist, a Nazi end of it.
Yeah. And around that, there's a whole plethora of other different groups like the neo-pagans and the pagan traditionalists, Christian traditionalists, conservative nationalists, all sorts of different flavors of libertarians, the men's rights movement. But also there's a sort of traditional female movement growing up where women want to live traditional lives where men are doing the working and they're looking after families and raising that kind of thing. Also, there's the burgeoning human biodiversity movement. And these people are very interested in the differences between races, different variances in intelligence levels and capabilities and how they differ without making it too racist. I mean, they're quite interested in ideas that homogenous societies work better. So there's all these ideas happening in there.
A lot of ideas, yes, and a lot of them are hugely controversial, if not just plain pseudoscience. This is a movement with few leaders and, as of yet, a lack of a coherent ideology or strategy. But they do agree on some things, perhaps chief among them, opposition to political correctness and to immigration, particularly immigration to the West from the Middle East. And here's the interesting bit. Those concerns resonate with ordinary voters in America. Listen to these Donald Trump supporters who've been stopped on the street by the BBC in California and elsewhere. They're not, as far as we know, alt-right, just ordinary conservatives.
I think that a guy like him, who's not political, who is not polished, not saying what everybody wants to hear, is exactly the kind of guy who can get something done and would really do it.
He's worried about terrorism from Islamic extremists and I'm in fear for my life.
Saying what everybody's politically afraid to say about immigration.
You know, I know he's causing a little stink with all the stuff he says, but I think he's awesome.
Oliver Lee Bateman is a freelance journalist, and in the course of writing for Vice magazine, he got to know 24 or so alt-right activists in the U.S. Now, this is more difficult than it sounds, because generally, they don't use their own names online and would prefer to cook up clever tweets than talk to journalists. From his admittedly limited sample, Oliver Lee Bateman gave me his impression of the kinds of people who are drawn to the alt-right.
If they're college students, and I've talked to them, they're college students who might be bright, but they don't feel like they fit in or they feel like they're being put upon. If they're in their 30s, they feel like, quote unquote, they're losing their country. The country's identity is changing. They're often people who work completely boring, bureaucratic or programming jobs. They don't want to put their names and faces out there. That's a common characteristic.
Although Oliver Lee Bateman sees some demographic consistency, he also sees a movement divided between intellectual leaders, of which there are relatively few, and garden variety trolls. If one thing brings them together, it's Donald Trump.
I quickly realized that the folks that I was talking to were among the most articulate and educated within that group. But then there's this level below them, and they're running these very gross sort of hate group pages that's filled with a lot of old school racists, conspiracy theorists, people that just want to post caricatures of Jewish people that are very disgusting. A lot of the users hide behind cartoon images or fake names because they know some of these ideas are repugnant. And when Trump came along, and began saying things like, I'm going to build a wall, or began saying things like, you know, Saddam Hussein wasn't a bad guy. He killed terrorists. He kept people from leaving the country. They liked that. They felt that he was opening this so-called window to all kinds of discourse that we weren't able to say. A lot of them didn't trust that he would be the perfect candidate for them, but they were really, really happy that he was able to get away with saying so many things that hadn't been said for so long in the United States.
Until Trump came along, only fringe Republicans in American politics called for mass deportation of immigrants, for banning Muslims, or for border walls. Those positions are rare red meat to the alt-right, although some strands of the alt-right go even further. Many of them want an ethnically pure, all-white homeland on the North American continent. They seem to be united by division.
I'm not sure a lot of us see some great big super huge ethno-state that spans from Europe to Australia, but we would like people in their own countries.
Ian Davis, the British alt-right activist, says that in this country, the alt-right movement is growing, although...
it's nowhere near as big as the American scene. And I'm not surprised. We're the nation that fought fascism. You know, we're renowned and we pride ourselves on the fact that we went and bashed Hitler. And it's always going to be associated with this national socialist element when, in truth, we're probably nearer to the kind of conservatism you saw 30, 40 years ago.
Anthony Smith, the journalist from Mike, who dug up the Star of David story, says the alt-right is quite difficult to quantify. They use these extreme free speech websites like 8chan, the one I mentioned before, but even on Twitter and Facebook, most don't reveal their real names. But he has no doubt that the alt-right is starting to make an impact on mainstream politics.
We don't have an idea of like how many of these people are out there, but they congregate around 8chan's poll board is one place they go. Poll being short form for political correctness. It's an ironic name. It's obvious. It's an extremely politically incorrect board. Comment sections of blogs, Milo Yiannopoulos on Twitter. And there are so many people out there. And the whole idea that was, you know, sort of in this room, Paul Gottfried saying we need to create an independent right that isn't sort of tied to any specific place. That's what we see today. If it took Obama's election to bring them out of the shadows, it took the rise of Trump to embolden them. And they are no longer a fringe concern. They are mainstream.
That was Mike Wendling with that report. He's with me now in the briefing room. And with us, one of the focal points of the alt-right movement mentioned in that last soundbite by Anthony Smith, Milo Yiannopoulos. He's one of the stars of the alt-right scene in the US, but he's British. He writes for the right-wing Anglo-American website Breitbart. Since that interview, he's been kicked off Twitter, but not before amassing around 500,000 followers, which gives you some idea of the scale of what we're talking about. In our New York studio, Kathy Young, who's a columnist and writer, a conservative herself, but definitely not from the alt-right. Milo Yiannopoulos, if I can start with you, how would I judge whether or not the alt-right was actually a thing?
It's interesting because it's the first example, I think, in politics of something that's happened in culture for quite some time. You've had these amorphous, leaderless internet movements of people who like to act anonymously. In a sense, that's sort of your problem and not theirs. They don't care too much about whether journalists can get a handle on them. They see the media, in many cases, as the bad guys. You know, what these people do represent, however, is a very, very large section of the population. In America, I would say that the pro-Trump and anti-Trump people in the Republican base is probably 50-50, maybe even now stretching over to 60-70% Trump. There's a huge overlap in the Venn diagrams between the alt-right and Trump supporters. This is a very significant sea change in conservatism in the West.
How would we judge its impact in that case? Because when a group is amorphous, is largely anonymous, it can make any of the claims that you care to make. And as you quite correctly say, it's very difficult for a journalist like me to judge whether that's actually true.
Well, I think the electoral impact is quite clear. In the UK, the Brexit vote was opposed by pretty much the entire establishment here. Yet despite all of that hectoring, the naturally sort of libertarian, mischievous, dissident, defiant attitude of people who I suppose would be described as the alt-right. I'm not completely persuaded that there is such a thing in the UK yet. But people who may be in the alt-right one day came out. In the US, Trump, whose voters are motivated by many of the same concerns that motivate the alt-right, that is sort of nativism, nationalism, and anti-political correctness, That is a gigantic movement in American politics. Trump is selling out stadiums with tens of thousands of people in them. He is the Republican nominee for president. I mean, what more do you want?
Well, yeah, except that you seem to have lumped together, if you like, a kind of largely internet-based movement with a much more conventional political movement, even if it has people in it.
Oh, no, I was rejecting the definition outright, that the alt-right is an internet-based movement. You see some bits of the alt-right on the internet. The vast majority of the movement consists of people who don't even know the term alt-right. You know, it is a gigantic and very significant new era in conservative politics in the West.
Well, at least no one can accuse you of underclaiming. But one of the aspects of the interesting article that you wrote with Alan Bokhari for Breitbart, you called it an establishment conservative's guide to the alt-right, was essentially this, at best you'd call it playfulness, at worst you'd call it, I suppose, provocations.
Why is provocation so bad?
Provocation isn't so bad, but in and of itself, it is not fundamentally serious. And so the question I wanted to understand was whether or not you were talking about a political movement which to you is serious.
Oh, no, this idea of seriousness is part of the reason people have been turned off politics and turned off mainstream journalists, this sort of high-minded insistence that everything has to be elevated. People like to have fun, and they like to talk about politics in the same terms they talk about things that actually matter to them, like love, sex, death and money. They like to talk about politics in real terms. Journalists and politicians have forgotten how to do that. And this idea that just because the alt-right likes mischief and fun and dissidence doesn't make them unserious. Actually, it makes them the most serious free speech advocates that we've seen in decades.
Ordinarily, I suspect that most ordinary people talk about death quite seriously, but I'm sure there's a kind of substratum of people
we'll
who are regarded
sex,
as essentially funny. But we'll go with the sex. Cathy Young, you're not a knee-jerk liberal, and you've been highly critical of the alt-right movement.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I would actually describe myself not as a conservative so much as, I guess, a moderate libertarian, if that's even a thing.
Not much space in the left for you anymore.
That is very true. But, you know, these days I'm also wondering if there's any space for me on the right. So I am politically homeless, and here I am. I totally agree that we should be able to have fun and, you know, not be serious all the time. But, you know, I would kind of hope that, you know, people's ideas of mischief do not necessarily boil down to sending Auschwitz cartoons to Jews on Twitter. I do think that there is a very real kind of strain of ugliness and bigotry that, you know, is being legitimized here. And, you know, I do know that part of the problem is that the left has kind of made these terms meaningless because, you know, if you can be accused of bigotry for, I don't know, wearing a sombrero on Halloween because that's cultural appropriation.
Which actually happened on an American university campus.
Yes. And, you know, these words kind of lose their meaning. At the same time, if you look at what some of these people have on their Twitter feeds and on their blogs in some cases, many of them have, it's pretty clear, a very serious commitment and interest in anti-Semitic, racist ideas. It's really not just people having a little fun. And this is something that I think is a real problem. I mean,
here's the thing about the internet.
Mike Wendling.
There's a lack of context. So if somebody puts up an offensive image or an image that somebody may think is offensive, it's really hard to tell whether they're joking or not.
Yes, which is precisely why, although I have a completely different analysis of the situation than Cathy does, ultimately neither of our opinions matter very much because we're incapable of reading other people's minds and determining intention.
So I guess when the average person
sort
is coming...
I would question that. If you look at the entirety of a person's Twitter feed, most of the time I think you can tell
Cathy,
if they're joking.
You've done such good reporting on this in the past. I find it so remarkable that you, as somebody who has been one of the foremost defenders of free speech in the press in America, suddenly now, for reasons I can't work out, are drawing a distinction between good provocation and bad provocation.
Milo Yiannopoulos, if I could just interject with a question here, which kind of clarify it in my own mind, because this is very unclear. Now, if I was a Nazi,
yes,
and there are some,
yes,
and I was to send some of this stuff out to Jews, it's difficult to tell. But if I was, or if I was just a communal garden racist, or if I was somebody who'd had a kind of desire to be more racist than I was actually allowed to be and felt permitted by present circumstances, anonymity, to do it,
yes,
What would be the difference between what I sent out to Jews and what your playful people sent out to Jews?
Well, I can tell you the real racists don't speak anything like the people that Kathy thinks are the monsters, right? They are very serious. They are deep into studies and data attempting to prove that certain races are smarter than other races. They are really into this stuff. For the most part, they're really dorky. And let's remember also, a lot of these guys are 17 years old. When they see the right banging on about anti-Semitism, they see no distinction whatsoever between that and feminists banging on about sexism or Black Lives Matter banging on about racism. They correctly see that the majority of the allegations about sexism and racism made by the media are bogus. And because they have no living relatives who were in the Holocaust and have never been educated about why the Jewish thing is different, they see no difference when the right does it with anti-Semitism. And so when journalists with Jewish surnames take the bait and start biting back on Twitter, they make themselves a target for ritual humiliation that has nothing to do with anti-Semitism.
Sorry, can I be absolutely clear?
Milo, you know what? I absolutely agree that some of those people are trolling. But as I said, I mean, when you look at some of those Twitter feeds, they absolutely are into these websites that talk about some races being dumber than others. And I mean, they are into this stuff.
So, Milo Yiannopoulos, let's come back to this definitions that you created for the alt-right, because it seemed to me that actually part of the movement that you were talking about was a movement that wanted to embrace new racial theory. That's part of what the part of the movement is.
And therefore, it would be very clear to say that it was a tiny fraction. And there are racists on every end of the political spectrum, more racists on the left, actually. I mean, the Black Lives Matter want the same thing the KKK does, segregated dorms at colleges, all that kind of stuff. I really must resist this constant cry for seriousness, because this is precisely why people hate journalists and
politicians. Well, you were just being very serious.
No one here is making a constant cry for seriousness.
Hold on. I'm making quite a big cry for seriousness, in fact.
Okay.
No, this being a relatively serious programme, and actually some of these things being relatively serious issues, and something like Black Lives Matter, although doubtless it has deficiencies as a movement, at least it doesn't burn crosses on people's lawns and so on. And have a history of lynching. The equation of the KKK with something like Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter is far worse. They go after their own people. They live black cities in flames because they're so self-destructive.
I have a lot of issues with Black Lives Matter, but I really would not go so far as to acquaint them with the KKK. I mean, I think there are some people in the movement who do employ...
Kathy, you asked us to stay in the present day, the KKK is an irrelevance. It has zero purchase on public life.
Some of the people on the alt-right, I think, are smuggling in white supremacist ideas into the mainstream via the Trump campaign.
What they're resisting, as you know perfectly well, is this sort of constant hatred of the apocryphal straight white male of liberal journalism. What they're saying is that you're constantly telling us white people are the source of all evil, that white people have all this stuff to apologise for. Well, you know what? We're not that bad. We did some pretty good stuff. We did Mozart and Rembrandt and Descartes and Beethoven and Wagner, and we went to the stars. We explored the oceans. We built Western civilization.
Who did?
We're not that bad.
Sorry,
Western,
who did those
Western
things?
Civilization.
We shifted from being white males to being Western civilization.
Yes.
Now, that's an interesting conflation. What I'm seeking to find out is what it is you, if you associate with the alt-right, actually want. In your paper, you talk about the alliance that you can form with what you call natural conservatives.
Yes.
For whom, as you say, culture, not economic efficiency, is the paramount value. But you then go on partly to define it by what it describes as its tribal interests. Mm-hmm. And you effectively say white society has its own tribal interests, which it is perfectly legitimate for them to place alongside the tribal interests of other tribes. Is that your view?
Can't white people be proud of what white people have done? Well, black people are constantly telling us how proud they are of what black people have done. Women are constantly saying, if the left insists on breaking society up like this, then yeah, why can't white guys say, we did most of the good stuff in the world?
Kathy Young.
Basically, what Milo is saying here is the left, and I completely agree, by the way, I think the left's obsession with identity politics is really terrible. And so the answer really is to replicate that obsession and to extend it to white people.
Of course,
I mean, that's
not,
ridiculous.
Of
that's
course, of
perpetuating
course,
the problem.
Of course it isn't. And as I said earlier, obviously,
what exactly is the case that we're making here for the alt-right? It's going to alienate a lot of reasonable critics of political correctness, of who are going to see the anti-PC rebellion as associated with these white identity people.
Well, if they're stupid enough, to throw out their beliefs about free speech because they think it might be associated with somebody unsavory, then I don't care about them because they're idiots.
I think we're talking about something more serious, though, than that. I'm sorry to use the word serious again. So let's go back again to your own writings about it. You describe Donald Trump, for instance, as the first truly cultural candidate since Pat Buchanan.
Yes.
And that's obviously supposed to be a good thing. At least I take it from context.
Yes, I meant it as a compliment.
Yeah. What does it mean?
Many voters in the election in America coming up are not necessarily voting in their own economic interests. And that's not because they're idiots, but it is because they recognize that at this particular moment in history, it might be more important to pay attention to culture than economics. And I think something similar was going on with the Brexit vote. Americans are becoming aware that the American way might be better than everybody else's way. And maybe it's worth insulating it from inferior values and inferior models of how to run a society. America is the best country there has ever been. And there are a lot of Americans who would quite like it to stay that way.
Kathy Young.
The problem is that the alt-right really does tie culture to ethnicity and really does argue that America was created not as this universalist society based on liberal principles, but as a country for white people. I mean, they're pointing to early 18th century laws that reserved citizenship only for white people. This is what they're doing. This is what they're talking about.
But the trollish element of the alt-right does that stuff on Twitter.
It's not the trollish element.
I'm bound to point out to you that there's a contradiction in what you've been saying. And it's a surprising contradiction, really, for, if you like, a kind of half-Greek, British-purse, gay person in the United States to involve themselves so firmly in what seemed to be, to many people, to be kind of white identity politics from a very old and some people will feel a very dark place.
Well, I'm Jewish too, by the way.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you, doesn't any of this worry you?
No, you are falling into exactly the trap that the alt-right is resisting with its mocking of identitarian politics. You're suggesting that because of what I am, I shouldn't hold certain beliefs. I reject the premise of your question utterly.
I actually absolutely agree. I think that all of us, whatever our identity may happen to be, should oppose bigotry. I don't believe in putting people in boxes. I think that's exactly what the alt-right does. It's really kind of ridiculous to discount all of the ethno-nationalist aspects of their rhetoric.
Don't you think that perhaps the result of the alt-right might be great? And if you don't like Donald Trump and you find him aggressive and obnoxious and irritating and distasteful, the effect of him, you know, smashing political correctness, might be great.
Well, that leads
everybody to
realize.
That
leads me on to my final question.
Well, then I'll let you do it.
Well, precisely, which is there anything for the alt-right after Trump?
Of course. Of course, what they've demonstrated is the insanity and absurdity of identity politics. The vast majority of people in this movement believe in principle over ethnicity, freedom of speech, libertarianism, and, you know, free intellectual inquiry. If the effect of Trump and the effect of the alt-right is to make the unsayable sayable again, wonderful. I don't know how long the Trump candidacy and or presidency is going to go on. And I think after Trump, there will still be some work left to do. And that work will be done not by journalists who ought to have been doing it, but by the alt-right.
Kathy Young, is there any future for the alt-right after Trump, or is it a sort of temporary phenomenon?
The alt-right, it probably is here to stay. I think that we're going to see more polarization. I absolutely reject the idea that the alt-right is the only or even the principal movement that opposes political correctness. So I think that, you know, the alt-right probably after Trump may recede to a more marginal role. But again, I really have no idea what will happen. I think, unfortunately, we're going to see more polarization.
Kathy Young sensibly eschewing prediction. I'm going to eschew prediction too, but I'd like to thank her, Milo Yiannopoulos, and our reporter Mike Wendling for briefing us on the alt-right. And just to sum up, this is what I think we've learned. The alt-right is an alternative movement in the sense that it's a right wing that isn't tied to the political establishment, but it's an amorphous movement rather than a coherent organisation or even a coherent set of ideas. What unites the alt-right, it seems to me, is what it's against. Immigration, political correctness, things like that, rather than what it's for. So to go back to the question I ask, is it actually a thing? Yes, I think it is. And thanks to Donald Trump, it's no longer just a subculture. It could become a big, important thing with a leader. Till next week, goodbye.
The Briefing Room was presented by David Aronovich, and the producer was Mike Wendling. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd love you to share your comments and star rating on a podcast provider site such as iTunes. And if you like this type of programme, you'll probably also like the BBC World Service series The Inquiry. Just search for BBC World Service The Inquiry.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.